listen to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to Rogue Startups, episode 146. This week, Dave and I have 10 stories of why startups have failed. So this is going to be a positive and uplifting episode. As always, I think we're kind of piggybacking on the last one, right, Dave?
A little bit, yeah. You know, we're doubling down on sad and depressing here in honor of my teenage daughter's music choices these days. She's like seriously into Fall Out Boy, which she tells me is like part of the emo trinity. Along with My Chemical Romance and somebody else. And I have listened only a little bit to some of the music, but it is absolutely sad and depressing for the most part. So I can confirm that, yeah, we're channeling her today.
Oh, man. I don't know what any of those words mean. That's crazy. I'm old and like a foreigner at the same time now. This is crazy.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, you know, just waiting, you know, you within the next 7 to 10 years, you'll get a pretty solid feel of what this is like.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll just be the European version of sad and depressing. I just don't know what that looks like.
Right. Yeah, no. So my daughter is 7 going on 15. And so I know it's right around the corner. So yep, for sure.
So today's episode was inspired by a thread that we actually found on Hacker News. And these ones pop up every now and then, and I read them, and I'm just utterly fascinated by all of the stuff that comes out in these threads. And it's, you know, some of it is like the traditional, yeah, you shouldn't be doing that. And others just have some really wacky, crazy-ass shit going on, like Mexican drug cartels or bank cartels. So that's one of the stories that we've got for you today. So just hang on and we'll get to the Mexican bank cartel story about some startup that actually learned, quote unquote, not to fuck with the cartels.
Right.
As if that was a lesson that you had to learn beforehand. Like, does anybody ever sit around going, you know, today I just kind of want to fuck with the cartels? I
think right. I'm going to go to TJ and then rile some shit up. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, have they not seen Sicario? Have they not watched any of those movies about Pablo Escobar from the 80s or Traffic? Yep. Or you just don't fuck with the cartels ever. Reminds me of that line from The Princess Bride. You fell prey to one of the classic blunders. Slightly less well known as this, or the first is never wage a land war in Asia, but the second, slightly less well known as this, never go up against the Sicilian when death is on the line.
Wonderful movie. No, absolutely wonderful movie. Yep. No, so, you know, with these, Dave, I think there's like, I think we'll probably recap at the end, two or three major themes that kind of weave throughout all of these stories, right?
Yes. There's definitely some thematic tie-ins across all of these stories. And without further ado, let's just jump into the first story here and talk about it and see what lessons we can draw from it.
Yeah, no, for sure. So the first one is the story from one guy of two of his startups. And kind of in startup number one, the problem was, it was too hard to believe it could be big. So they went out and tried to get a bunch of kind of big VC money, but kind of didn't financially make sense, I guess, that it could be valued at kind of unicorn status, so like a $1 billion company or something like that. So I think the moral of this story is that, like, if you're going to be kind of running more of a lifestyle business or something that's going to make a bunch of money but isn't going to be the next Zendesk or something like that, in terms of runway and funding and things like that, try to look for another way that's not typical VC money to kind of get out ahead and get your runway so that you can find product market fit. The second one that the guy is talking about is like a classic, he calls it a nightmare founder story, where after they raise a bunch of money, the startup kind of founder landscape changed and it kind of wrecked everything. to where there was just really kind of bad cultural fit within the organization and stuff like that. And he summarizes it with kind of saying, like, don't try to get 1,000 things right. Try to get one thing right and then kind of rely on the rest of your team to get it, which my favorite thing is close enough to have all the other pieces fit into place good enough. But if you're doing the one thing really well, then everything else that's close enough will certainly be good enough for your business to be successful. So I think that's kind of the lesson from the first guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And one other thing that I want to comment on the first guy is that he was saying that in both cases that they had this product and that, you know, that was a widely loved consumer website in the first case. And the second one had a great business model, product market fit, high growth, but it was like a personality thing that the founder just didn't get it. So, you know, something else I think you want to take away from this is that if you're a founder, growing your culture is as important as growing the business. And you have to decide, what is it that we are going to stand for? What is it that's important to us? What is it we want to represent? If you don't ask those questions will get answered for you, whether you want them to or not. And in some cases, you may not like the result at the end, which it sounds like startup number two was pretty much what they ended up having there. Wouldn't mm-hmm. you agree?
No, totally. And I think that as someone who's only run kind of two decently sized remote teams, being remote makes it even more important and challenging to focus on culture. We're just getting to the point now, I feel like, where we have some time and energy to focus on culture a little bit with Castos. And I think it's important, and I hope we're doing a good job with it. But it is important to me, and we're going to start allocating more time and resources to just having chats and having a virtual cup of coffee and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, if you don't get culture right as your business grows, especially past 10 people or something like that, you're totally screwed.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, we're going to link to the thread. So if you want to troll through all of the responses inside of HN, you can see what the stories are. We're not even going to cover a small fraction of what stories came up in this thread here. We're just highlighting 10 that we thought were the most interesting.
Yep.
So that brings us to number two here. And this guy apparently went in and chased and won a huge customer for his small startup. And as part of that, he also won a sole service contract for a key part of the business. But in doing so, he fell into a classic freelancer productized service trap. And that was, he basically kept getting the song and dance from their accounts payable department saying, well, we need you to extend us credit. And then he had 60-day net payment terms, which is absolutely insane for a freelancer. If you have anything longer than net 30, let's talk, because you are leaving money on the table and putting your business at huge risk. But anyway, he allowed a credit situation to grow with them for the course of 3 months with 60-day net terms. And then after that 90 days, they went out of business, leaving him holding the bag with $150,000 in accounts receivable unpaid.
It hurts to hear that.
Oh, God. And he says he spent $90,000 generating that for them. So, I mean, wow. Where do we start with the lessons on this one? So, first of all, 60-day terms suck. Don't do that. Second of all, after 30 days, he should have started hounding the hell out of them and say, you know, hey, I'm a small business and I can't extend this level of credit for this long. And obviously he wasn't comfortable saying that, but in doing so, he just sat there and started racking up way more risk and liability than he could really afford to deal with. And lastly, you know, I don't know what his contract terms were, but he should have probably had some kind of a clause in there that said something to the effect of late payment fees, 10% a week for every week overdue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, just something that makes it unpalatable to not pay on time. And then there was like a whole discussion in the thread about other people's suggestions to it and say, you know, hey, offer a discount for on-time payment or make really substantial. I think he had something really light in there, like 3% for every month overdue or something, or 2% or a month overdue. So basically the company was using him for a really cheap bank.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, dude, facepalm, don't do it. Yeah, that was bad. That was bad.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a freelancer, so I can't talk to the difficulty and the trouble of collecting from you know, people that owe you money. But I do know that, like, if I were to do it, having some kind of recourse or holding some kind of deliverable until all the money is paid or something would be something I would definitely try to bake in. Some kind of, like, you pay in advance or you pay part up front and part at the end or something like that, so that you're not held with all of this at the end. I think the other part is generally kind of like the enterprise thing is it's kind of the same as, like, in a lawsuit, the first person to get sued is the person with the biggest pockets. In a situation like this, the person that's going to end up doing the screwing to everyone else is the one who can afford either to say, fuck you, I don't really care, we're going to go out of business, or yeah, take me to court and we'll just drag you through the legal process for the next 6 months until you give up. If it's a big business that can and wants to do that because they have the legal resources and the capital to do it, then they will. And you as a small business or a freelancer or something like that can't survive long enough to deal with the crap they're going to deal you.
No. That's absolutely true. The little guy always loses there.
Yeah. Always. Yeah. So, I mean, however you can kind of manage that, I think probably for me, it would be like holding part of the deliverable until you're paid is the simplest thing. Cause then you never get too far in over your head. I mean, 150 grand in unpaid AR is, I mean, I don't care what you think the upside is going to be later. That's obviously a killer.
Yeah, just have some clear milestones and say this deliverable will be delivered on this date contingent upon payment.
Yeah.
You know, you write that into a contract, very straightforward, and as soon as they stop paying, you just stop delivering. And you can say, look, I can't keep working on this if I'm not getting paid.
Yeah.
It's pretty straightforward. You know, that's just the way business works. And some companies don't want to honor that, and some companies can't honor that. Like, I worked one time as a freelancer for this company that the guy was basically bootstrapping the whole thing out of his own pocket. And I think at one point he was running into serious cash flow issues. So he went to, like, friends and family to get more investment, but it took him a lot longer to get the money than he anticipated. So there was, like, I want to say a 60-day period where we just weren't getting paid. But the guy I was working with, super smart, very savvy when it came to freelancing. He's like, well, Dave, we are not getting paid right now, so we need to stop work. And I'm like, okay. He said, if you've got another client, I would suggest trying to ramp them up right now. And if this guy comes back and does his thing again, then we can restart the project. But right now he's got no money to pay us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, he just laid it right out on the line. And I'm like, great. Thanks for that. I appreciate that. And it saved me some headache, although I did have to go chasing after that guy for a relatively small amount of AR that was like $2,000 to $4,000 or something like that. I mean, it was a lot to me, but it wasn't like I need to end my entire business over this.
No, and I mean, we've done a little bit of, like, I don't know, consult, like, one-time work at Podcast Motor. People come and say, we want to do 20 or 50 or whatever episodes, and we want to do them all at once. And for those, we just do half up front and half when we're done. So that, like, worst case, I cover my costs if they don't pay us when we're done, but I don't lose my ass, you know? And so I think if anybody's looking at doing this as part of, like, a SaaS, like a service with a SaaS or anything like that, just get half it up front, half it when you're done. Everyone in the world should be cool with that, especially if you already have a relationship with a customer. And then you totally, like, eliminate the big risk of just totally getting screwed like this guy.
Yeah.
So the third one here is talking about VCs. And Dave, I feel like we sometimes, most of the time, probably have
all the time. No, not really.
No. Man, I think
we've had good guys on to talk about the positive side of VC. I don't want.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's, like, it's a spectrum, right? I mean, there is definitely, like, the grow at all cost type venture capital money, and there's the people who honestly want to have, like, alignment with you to create the type of business that you want to have and they want to have as an investor. And I think that's really what this guy kind of comes down to, is like aligning the investor philosophy with the founder's vision. And it's not just all about making cash. It's, you know, having values and working towards those values and making sure that the people that you're serving are always kind of considered in the decisions that you make every day and stuff like that. You hear Josh Pigford from Baremetrics talk about this a lot. Like, he took a little bit of money and was really happy with it, I think, because he's totally cool with the guys that are funding him, and they're kind of all aligned with the direction that Baremetrics is going, and everybody's happy. And then I think if you're in a situation like, I don't know, Pinterest, right? That like you just want users and activation and all this kind of stuff, then you gotta probably be cool with being associated with a VC that's just grow, because the end goal for them is like a big, huge payday at some point when it goes public or gets bought by Google or whatever. So I think for most of us, the moral is like, if you're going to take money, make sure that those people want to do the same things you want to do.
Yeah, just goal alignment. And this should be true whether you're talking about co-founders, people that you're hiring, people that you're trying to get funding through. Just make sure everybody's on the same page about it. And I think that goes a long way in sort of righting any wrongs that you might run into there, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure.
All right. So the next one, are you familiar with FAMZU?
No.
Okay. All right. So FAMZU is this app where basically you can do financial management with your family and your kids in particular. And you can actually get them prepaid debit cards and transfer money back and forth between your accounts that you hook up to this thing and into their prepaid debit cards. So you can use it for like allowances and chores, and you can do like all this online deduction and crediting, and, you know, your kid buys some candy at the store. Okay, take out $1.50 for the gum that they bought at the grocery store in line. Or they did some chores in the backyard, like my kids have to scoop the dog poop in the backyard. And if one of them does that, then I pay them a certain amount of money for that, because nobody likes to do that chore. And so it basically allows you to do this, you know, family financial management. Well, here's a story about a guy that says he built an app like that, kind of in the same vein, but he says it was a family currency where kids would pick chores they wanted to do, and then they would earn points based on the difficulty of the chores. So it's a different currency that he's gotten there. And then those points could be redeemed in a different marketplace for real life rewards. So it might be like hosting friends for a sleepover, fishing trip with dad, play a game with mom, screen time, whatever. So this guy, classic mistake, he didn't figure out what his marketing plan was up front and try to build an audience and try to get, you know, have this thing for pre-launch. What he did instead, he actually did think about marketing. So he's got that going for him. But he did his due diligence and he looked at the cost per click for ads for the keywords that he was looking at were around 20 cents a click. And then he threw in some basic conversion rates and figured out what his CAC was going to be, and that was around 10 bucks. And then he did a lowball average for the lifetime value of his customer, and he thought it was 18 bucks if they stayed for 3 months on average, which I think that calculation was probably a bit bogus. If you can't keep your customers more than 90 days, you probably shouldn't be doing whatever it is you're doing, unless your product just has no lifetime on it, you know, whatever. Anyway, that aside, so he basically took a year and a half, 15 months or 18 months to build the app. He finished it and then decided to launch his marketing campaign and found that the cost per click had skyrocketed 100x.
Mm-hmm.
So now all of a sudden, he's getting a cost to acquire a customer at $100 with his supposed average lifetime value of 18. And then he went to some backup marketing plans for mommy bloggers, and then didn't have enough time to scale his customer base and blast out the ad campaign, and he ran out of runway.
Yeah.
So naturally, it cratered, and that's bad. So obviously, the lesson here you got to have an audience. And if he had had that audience up front and had been engaging them earlier in the phase, he could have gotten them excited with screenshots and, you know, maybe conference calls and sit down sessions and incentivize them with like an Amazon gift card. Hey, come spend half an hour with me and talk to me about this product and tell me what you think and how you would use it and what, you know, just engaging that market. And then when he gets ready to release, not only does he have somebody to release it and sell it to, but they've participated in the process and he's got a fairly strong idea that what he built would actually be what they wanted.
Yeah. So I was reading over the weekend after, so Dave, our last episode really kind of got me. And so I left like our last episode and almost didn't publish it, right? It went out on Friday instead of Thursday because Thursday morning I was like, it's depressing and hard and like kind of a failure for me. And like, so I almost didn't publish it because I was like, this sucks. But afterwards I published it and then I said, I got to figure out what I'm doing. I went and read over the weekend the Traction book. So like pretty popular marketing framework.
Oh yeah, Gabrielle Weinberg.
Yep. So in that book, they talk about when you are developing your product, you should be spending half of your time testing your marketing channels. So they have like these 19 different marketing channels. Within each one, there's a bunch of different, you know, subcategories and stuff like that. But this is where this guy fell down, right? He spent zero time marketing his product and connecting with his audience and testing things. Because part of it is like marketing and part of it is customer development through marketing almost, you know, like doing demos and figuring out what people like and why they churn and stuff like that. And like early on, churn is not bad. It's just an indicator of like why your product sucks. And so you can fix it. So, yeah, I mean, I think the moral for me of this is like talk to people early, obviously, but figure out as you're going what your marketing channel is. And this is where I think I've fallen down with Sales Camp is like, I've not really been focused on marketing because I'd known the product wasn't like 100%. And it's just because I'm chicken shit, you know, and I should say like, I'm going to go market this and accelerate the feedback I get so that we can build a better product with more data. Because it is like marketing and churn and stuff brings out the shortcomings in your product faster, which is good because in a lot of times, like it's money, but it's also like time and energy and mental capacity that we have for a business that can run out. So that's what I take away from that one.
Yeah, that part is tough. That's always tough to, you know, build something and then not put the effort into the channel behind it. So yeah, I mean, yeah. I can't say I've been doing awesome at that. And with Recapture, I mean, we went into the whole strategy with the Shopify migration. And I've been getting some customers on the other side of it, but they're not sticking around and they're not using my product over competing products. So there's some tough lessons to be learned in there about understanding what they want, understanding what the alternatives are, understanding whether you're really better than your competitors or not. And that's a tough thing to look at and see.
Yep.
Which brings us actually to the next story.
Yep. Yep. So the next one is really like, you know, the headline is you hear these a lot, but they're worth repeating. And the first one is like an MVP is a real thing. And the guy says, you know, he probably spent too much time polishing and finishing the project and his competitors launched early and iterated fast and had a bunch of traction before he launched. And ended up just being kind of too late to the party by the time he fully launched. So I think like this is the launch early and iterate quickly. And if you're not doing that, then the chances of someone else coming in and getting that kind of first spot in the market definitely is potential. The second one is a classic, like developing software and more features, I would say, is another part of this is like developing more features, thinking that like another feature is going to make your product successful. Is a lie we tell ourselves to avoid doing marketing. And this is even me, and I'm like, I'm not a developer, so I have to be a marketing guy. but it's easy for me to say, oh, let's have the developers develop this other product or feature instead of me getting off my ass and figuring out a marketing channel. which is why I really liked and like really resonated with me in the Traction book, spend 50% of your time on product and 50% of your time on marketing. And it probably should be about the same through the life of your product, and kind of runs in cycles and iterations. And then the last one here for this guy is writing software for developers sucks. All developers think that they can create the same thing that you did for free, basically just with their time. So I think I probably would never build a product for developers just because I'm not a technical person. But I think for the developers out there, just I think the term would be like price sensitivity that is really strong in developers because they can do it at least as good as you are.
That was as nicely put as you could have possibly ever done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a generic term, right?
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of people that love building products for developers. I have shied away from it mainly because of the price sensitivity issue, partly because there's this snobbery of, oh, I could write that in a weekend. You know, that's the typical HN response. They look at Airbnb and they're like, I could write that in a weekend. Of course, they can't write it in a weekend. And that the software was only one small piece of that thing there, but people don't necessarily get that. And I also understand that you're talking to people that may not end up being your customers, and some people can make money selling stuff to developers. I mean, Atlassian, which does Jira and Confluence and all that other fun
Trello
enterprise-y stuff. Yeah, Trello. I mean, these are not blips of outliers. I mean, they it can be done, but there is definitely some product market fit, some heavy marketing, understanding the audience, coming up with a good price point. I mean, if you were to talk to somebody like our friends Harry and Ted at Moreware, where they sell countertop software, estimating software, and they'd be like, why would I go do this thing over here where I can charge $19 a month and I have to struggle versus charging $300 a month to these guys and I'm the only game in town? Like, that doesn't make any sense to do one over the other. But everybody seems to like to go that developer route, and I think that's kind of crazy myself. I think it's just, what is it you know, and you tend to focus on what you know as opposed to getting out of your comfort zone and doing something that's
totally more
challenging.
Totally. Yeah. So it's knowing the market. And I think it's a fair trap for people to fall into. I mean, you know, podcasting or e-commerce or whatever, like it's, you have a better chance of being successful operating in a market that you know versus countertop software, which I probably would build the wrong product for, you know?
Yeah.
That's the trade-off I think there.
Right. Well, it helps to have somebody in the business. And I think it was Ted's brother that actually was in the countertop estimation business. And so that was sort of their inside track to the whole thing, to find out that there was like one, you know, that there was only one competing product and it sucked and it was hard to use and it didn't do all these other things and yada, yada, yada. So they could come in and clearly make something that was significantly better and then build a whole business around it. So,
Yep.
All right. So as promised, here is the don't fuck with the Mexican cartel story. So this guy has a story where he says his CEO would disappear for months at a time, and he had a lot of money, and I guess there were some cash flow problems. He would never tell the company where he was going. He wouldn't let anybody else talk to the investors, including this guy who was apparently the CTO, which is very weird, by the way. Because any startup I've ever been involved with, if you're one of the C-levels, you're sitting in board meetings with these people on a regular basis because your investors show up to the board meetings. They are on the board.
Yeah.
So this is super weird, super weird. Anyway, so I guess he stopped paying everybody, and then there was like 2 months where the CTO and the other employees weren't really getting paid, and so I guess the COO took what they could out of this fund and paid out as much as they were all owed to try to distribute it equitably. And then everybody found jobs elsewhere. And the experience, I guess, he got in this company turned out to be an okay thing because he was able to find another job and make it up in his signing bonus. So that all turned out okay. But here's the Mexican cartel part. So I guess they were trying to do a financial tech play in Mexico. So right there, you know, I, for those who may not be familiar, if you spend any time in Mexico, you will find that there is widespread corruption pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
The police are often in the pockets of anybody except who they should be working for, which is the people. And so they look the other way when people are doing shady and illegal things. And it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about the gas companies or you're talking about the local auto parts dealer or somebody at the border that's the customs officer. They're all – there's a good chance that, whoever you're dealing with is on the take somewhere. But anyway, these guys were dealing with some Mexican banks, and they found out later that there was like one in particular called Banco Azteca, which it's gone. This bank has been since dissolved. But apparently, according to the old Wikipedia page, they had a uniquely effective debt collection system. And this uniquely effective debt collection system was a motorcycle gang that would show up at your door after you got a loan with massive and impossible to pay off interest rates, and failing to pay them back meant that they came to beat the crap out of you with baseball bats or take enough of your property to make up the difference. And that was one of the people that was funding their startups. So yeah, don't fuck with the cartels.
Yeah, that's the bad kind of pressure of outside investment, right?
Yeah, yeah. And this guy was talking about how he was driving around in Juarez, and he was in armored vehicles with security details. And he says, oh, that was fun. And I'm thinking, no, it's not fun. No. That's a huge red flag. I just saw Sicario the other day, and I'm like, I'm never going to Juarez. Never.
No. Well, yeah, I mean, I think most of us will never have to deal with this kind of thing. But I mean, I think the good thing is, like, or the important thing is here, that taking money and being indebted to people may make you be in uncomfortable and bad situations you don't want to be in. Maybe it's a motorcycle gang. Maybe it's, you know, being kind of responsible and having to answer to people that you don't want to. I don't know. But those are all bad things.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the thing that I took away from this was know who your investors are. Again, be on the same page with them. If you're not into illegal and scary things, then maybe taking money from somebody who's an illegal operative and doing scary things might not be the best choice. And if you know that the company that you're involved with has that, you know, I would certainly not be wanting to be in there, although I probably would have not gotten involved a lot earlier, because financial tech in Mexico already sends up a bit of a red flag from my previous experience with customs officials going over the border.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy.
No, it's crazy. It's crazy. So the seventh one here is kind of a three-parter, three kind of little lessons. And I love the first one because I've not heard this before in our world, Dave, is if people from outside of the tech world end up controlling your software startup, you're fucked, basically. And that pretending otherwise will just make it worse. So kind of putting on the blinders or the ostrich like head in the sand thing won't work. So I've not heard of this other than like PE firms coming in and taking control of a startup that they have significant investment in. But it surely makes sense that someone with all comes back to like alignment of interest and goals. Someone with interest that is not to your customers and the problem you're solving with your technology is going to create a problem. And I think the way some of these financing and investment deals are made, that those people can come in and oust you. You know, I was like reading the story of Twitter, right? Like from back in the day with Ev Williams, and like if they invest a bunch of money in your business, they own your business basically, and they can fire you as CEO and stuff. So I don't know. I guess lesson is, if you're going to take a bunch of money, hopefully don't ever give up controlling interest of your company. That's one thing. And two is take money only from people who are in the tech world and invest only in tech. so that hopefully they stay aligned with kind of your product and the vision you have for serving your customers.
Yeah. And for context, we didn't mention this to start with here, but this guy worked on two different startups. One of them was like a post-Napster hysteria about DRM and music distribution. And the other one was thinking that they were going to be buried by Orkut. Do you remember Orkut?
No, not at all.
I had to be honest, I had to look this one up because I forgot about them too. They were a social network owned by Google. Mm. So it was a social media thing by Google early on, and obviously it got buried by Plus and Facebook and Twitter and MySpace and pretty much everything, because I've heard nobody mentioned Orkut for years. I don't even remember any of my friends mentioning Orkut back in the day.
Yeah.
But obviously they were dealing with a bunch of people that were outside of their tech space, and sometimes that could be a good thing and sometimes that could be a bad thing. If they are controlling your startup and they've got a vision and that conflicts with what you're doing, again, this gets back to the make sure everybody's on the same page sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, then bad things happen.
Yep.
Very bad things happen.
Yeah, so the guy goes on to tell the story of how like great teams are incredibly rare, and like a good spouse or partner, if you have a good one, hold on to it with everything you can, right? So I feel very fortunate to have some good people working with me. Everybody working with me is really great, and I'm very fortunate. And I hope I appreciate it and respect it and give back to our teams. And I think that like it's a little bit of like the hell yes or no thing. Like if you can't say that your team is great, it's not. And you need to go back to the drawing board and do something different to get a great team. Because like when it's just past you doing a bunch of shit in your business, the only thing that matters is your team. You can have the best processes and SOPs and all this documentation and stuff, but like in the end, someone is going to execute that stuff. And if they suck, you're doomed. If they're great, the rest of your business can be kind of okay. But if like the team around you is really, really great, it picks up a lot of the slack, I think, that the rest of your business might kind of throw off and kind of make up for that. So I'm more and more think like pay more for people, hire senior level people, even early on, like, you know, I still am. Hire as good of people as you possibly can, because I think it really pays off. Less rewriting, less redoing, less, you know, customer churn because you're not taking care of those people, all this kind of stuff.
Do you know who Reginald Braithwaite is?
I do not.
So I think he's the CTO of PagerDuty. He's a big guy on Hacker News and does a lot of tweeting on Twitter as well. He's a super smart guy, very level-headed, has a lot of good things to say. I think he's Canadian. And he tweeted out something the other day when we were talking about something else that said, I always hire senior-level people. Sometimes I just catch them a little earlier in their career than others.
Mm, that's great.
And that's a smart thing to do. Like if you can find somebody who's got the potential to be a senior at a junior level and grow them, it's a rare thing to find, but these are amazing people. So a very good friend of mine, I hired him as a junior developer, and he was better at junior level than some of my senior developers in a startup that I worked for. That's the kind of people you want to work with.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not easy to find them, and I don't have a magic formula to give you. I don't even have like traits that you can look for specifically aside from, you know, they just go out and try to do things and get stuff done and make things more efficient and better for everybody. And how to suss that out, how to find those people, I'm not really sure. But when you see one of them, you'll know.
You know what I think it is? Because we've hired a ton of people at this point. It's really simple. It's giving a shit. And how to test for that or to make that part of your screening process is the hard part. But I mean, we kind of purposefully like give people half of an assignment and expect them to go figure it out, or give them an assignment that definitely has parts missing and expect them to come back to us and say, hey, this part is missing. Can you give me the rest of like the tools I need to figure this out? And because we're not trying to be mean, but we're trying to like kind of test them and say, like, if you just half-ass the assignment and give back kind of what I give you, that's not good enough. But if you go the extra mile and like ask for more information so you can do a really great job, then that's like the sign of somebody who really is going to take ownership of not just like the process, but the outcome. Cause that's the ultimate thing, is like anybody can work a process, but someone who owns the outcome is that next level person, I think.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
I wish there was a way to suss out the give a shit factor.
Yeah. We need a give a shit meter.
Give a shit meter. Yeah.
Give a shit meter.
If anybody has a startup out there that does that, I'm totally willing to pay to use your product to help find people who give a shit.
Yep. Yep.
The give a shit index.
So the next part, the last kind of part of this three parts lesson from this guy is, if the founders are not dog fooding their own product, you're doomed. And I think this has to do with like the product person, who a lot of times is the founder, their vision of what product market fit will look like. And that should have some data behind it, driven by customer conversations and trials and churn and stuff like that. But if you're not putting this out in people's hands, especially your own hands, you're totally fucked. I mean, we were using Castos when it didn't even work for this show, Dave. And that was a great learning lesson of like, okay, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. This breaks half the time. We need to fix this. And that let us go to market on a more broad scale with more confidence, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I love the way he says this here. I remember sitting at a table with founders while they tried to think of things that they could maybe do with, quote, the product. We had just spent months building and feeling the rats of doom nibbling at my toes. It never had occurred to me that this was a possibility.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So obviously if you're living in a bubble and you're not talking to customers and you're building the solution in search of a problem, I worked for a startup like this. It was an amazing piece of software, but they couldn't decide what problem it solved. So they decided that it solved any problem, and it kind of did. But selling that was really hard, and they did not have a ton of customers, and eventually it mostly was just a services company with a little bit of a product arm, and it never really went anywhere.
Yeah.
So this is very dangerous. Don't do it. All right. So the next one was a guy that says that 10 years ago, he built an e-learning web app. So it was like a mashup of Squarespace, Moodle, and Udemy. And then he links to like a demo in there. But apparently he had tons and tons of technical problems with this thing. And specifically, he had memory leaks, which to me means that he was probably writing this thing in C, C++, some non-memory managed language, where he basically didn't have the cash to pay expensive engineers to fix it. And so he tried to fix it himself, and he – I love this. I was given the choice of giving up my business or my wife.
That's real, man.
Yeah, it's totally real. And I'm thinking, well, I don't even know that that's really a choice, but yeah. He says, I don't regret choosing my family because they had another daughter before the marriage ended and she wouldn't be alive if I had chosen to continue with my business instead. Then he comes up with some very weird lessons on this one. I should have never given up. If you don't give up, you can't fail. Now that's complete bullshit.
Yeah.
That is such bullshit. You can not give up and just never know when to quit. I could have kept running with Support Vine for a much longer time than I did and burned way more than $50,000 in doing so. And it wouldn't have changed anything. I would have still been in the same market conditions as I had been before. I still had done not enough customer validation. I did not have an audience. All the same problems would have existed. It wasn't me not giving up that was the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, I think a lot of the guy talks through like five different lessons he has here. Four of them are a lack of product market fit and probably a lack of marketing. And like kind of the runway that marketing affords you, like kind of what we talked about last week a little bit, Dave, like if you have product market fit or you have some customers giving you feedback, or you know that the app is going to do what it needs to for your customers, then you can make it and you shouldn't give up. But if you don't know any of that stuff, then you will be faced with the like phase, you know, choose your family or your business. And that's like hopefully an obvious thing for everybody. But I mean, I feel sorry for this guy because like, yeah, he was strapped with some like technical problems that maybe, I don't know, you know, it's 10 years ago, maybe were avoidable, or like could put a Band-Aid on him at least, to where he could have like focused more on marketing to try and get this. Cause one of the things that, you know, he says is like, there's another player in the space now that's like valued over $1 billion. Maybe it's Udemy or something like that. But I think he sounds like he has a little bit of regret about not figuring it out, you know?
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, it seems like one mistake may not kill you, but multiple mistakes are going to compound and drive you into the ground faster. I think it's an exponential compounding effect. And totally. It sounds like he had multiple mistakes. Didn't have an audience, didn't get a runway, had, you know, he says that he didn't choose the right technology. So I don't believe that there's a right technology, but if you're, he chose some really exotic stuff. He did Python, which 10 years ago, Python was a little exotic. Today it's not so much, but he did these other two things that I don't even recognize called Plone and Zope.
No, I never heard of them.
Yeah, no. But if you choose an exotic tech stack, you're not going to necessarily have available developers or talent to draw from if you're trying to hire engineers to work on something. So, you know, don't go super exotic. Don't get weird about it. Just build a solution. Your customers don't give a shit what it's written in.
Yeah.
It either works or it doesn't. And when it doesn't work, it reflects on you and you can't execute, which clearly ended up happening to this guy. So he was saying that he didn't realize that specialists in this tech would be so difficult and expensive to hire. Well, if your thing is really exotic, I can tell you they're going to be difficult and expensive to hire. So don't do it. Don't do it.
Yeah. Yes.
And then, you know, it sounds like in the end he kind of made peace with it. But yeah, poor guy.
No, it's tough, man. It's tough. It's tough. Like reading these makes me reflect a lot, which I hope like in a good way, it makes everybody reflect. So we have like two more here real quick, but I hope it's like a positive reinforcement lesson for everybody. So the one here kind of second to last is a typical story. This guy says is like a visionary product that everyone liked, but nobody needed. And he likens it to the first iPhone.
Oh God.
Which is a big
cringe,
anybody
cringe.
Participating in Hacker News. That's a stretch. Not that, you know, I don't think Steve Jobs would ever be hanging out in Hacker News forums, but I think that, well, there's a lot to this. One, he talks about how he doesn't want to get out and sell. Tough. Like you got to go out and sell and talk to customers. You don't have to sell. You have to talk to customers. You can have a really soft, backhanded kind of like unassumptive selling style and sell a ton of stuff, especially in the tech world. The other thing is like having this, like everybody liked it, but nobody needed it is the very typical, like selling Skittles instead of Advil or whatever that saying is, like solve a real problem. Dave, we talk about like being close to the dollar. That's why you like e-commerce so much.
Yeah.
You know, get as close to people's wallets as you can. And if you can't explain your product, if you don't have like one sentence of what your business is and why and what it does for your customers, you're totally fucked. You know, if you can't say what you do in one sentence, you have no chance to have a conversation with somebody in like long form and actually sell them on something.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the saying that you were looking for was make sure that you're selling aspirin, not vitamins or candy.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah, that was the three high levels of hierarchy, right? So this guy was obviously into candy and, you know, aspirin is where it's at. So those are harder problems to solve. And then not talking to customers, that was a major mistake. And then thinking that you had this visionary product that's just living in your head. That's bullshit you're telling yourself. So yeah. you can't do that.
It's also very, very, very dangerous. We talked about it a little bit. Like any of us, anyone that listens to this podcast should not have a revolutionary product. You should have a slightly different version of a Me Too and try to compete in your space that's already established and validated. Because otherwise you're gonna run out of money. You know, nobody in our world is gonna go establish a new market or anything like that. It's just crazy.
It's certainly tough and it stacks the odds against you. I won't say never, but it's much tougher. And then there's always the pioneers get the arrows in the backs.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, right on. Yep.
It's a vision I always like. There's a Far Side picture, you know, the Far Side comic that shows some dude with a bunch of arrows in his backs. And I can't remember what the punchline is, but every time I say that, I always think of that comic, but it has a very strong visual aspect to it. And it's tough. You're putting yourself in a place where you're adding more odds against your success.
Yeah.
Some people could pull it off. I would say most of us would have a hard time with that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And the last one here, this kind of goes on the heels of a prior episode where we talked about co-founder relationships and bringing on a co-founder and making sure that you're on the same page and that kind of stuff. So this guy says his startup failed because his business partner wanted to be the quote idea guy who designed the screens and having him code and do all the heavy work. And initially this was going to be a 50-50 split, but after working on it full time for 6 months, he ran out of money and the other co-founder had a pretty big savings account, came from a well-off family. So he agreed to front the other guy to cover his rent while he was working on the app. And since we'll call him rich founder, poor founder, right?
There you go.
Since rich founder basically had, very little contribution, but, more hours, or he had fewer hours logged. The other guy was doing more hours. So they decided that the equity was based on the fact that rich founder was thrown in cash, poor founder was thrown in hours. I don't know that I would totally agree with all of that. And there would probably need to be some very hard discussions and some contractual agreements set up for something like that. But it sounds like none of this existed. So the guy continues and said after a couple more months, they had a working functioning app that was about 80% done. And then they started to butt heads. And rich founder claimed that he was frustrated by the app wasn't completely finished. But poor founder says that it changed scoped and redesigned the entire app no less than 3 times. So again, not talking to customers, this is probably rich founder's vision, no engagement with an audience, not getting real-time feedback. We have no idea, but that's kind of what it sounds like. And so rich founder reneges on the agreement of the 50-50 split, and then he opted to claim complete ownership and write poor founder out of the picture.
Yeah.
So
thanks a lot.
According to poor founder, he says this is his perspective. The rich founder saw that the app was getting beta users. He got dollar signs in his eyes and decided to be greedy. And both of them were young and naive. And the project had been built on a handshake deal, he says. So this sounds to me like no conversations were being had and nothing was written down. And this was all just pie in the sky. I'm hoping that the other person does the right thing kind of stuff. And when money and companies and businesses are involved, oral agreements are worth the paper that they're written on.
Yeah. No.
And these guys didn't want to spend 10 grand on lawyers and paperwork. And this is what it cost them. Everything. There's a punchline to the whole thing. And apparently it's been 10 years, he says. And I guess rich founder never finished the app and never got it over the hump and never launched it or whatever. So he ended up with crap on his hands anyway. So in the end, they both got screwed.
Yeah.
So it's just a sad story all around.
Yeah. You know, I think that with the 10 grand on lawyers and paperwork, like I think having an attorney look at stuff is certainly helpful, but it should not cost $10,000. I mean, I think if you're going into a partnership with somebody, you can write a Google Doc in plain English and say, this is what it's going to be, and talk through a lot of scenarios and have a partnership agreement, have a buyout agreement, have a bunch of scenarios about how you're going to value the entity or the assets or whatever, and save everybody a whole lot of time and money. And if it needs to go to an attorney that's $300 an hour, which is a very expensive attorney, it shouldn't take more than a few hours for them to legalize it into a proper agreement. Building an organization from scratch shouldn't cost more than a couple thousand dollars.
It comes down to not being able to communicate. If you can't have an honest conversation with somebody that you call a co-founder about equity splits, payments, buyouts,
especially at the beginning.
Yeah, like if you can't say, look, if somebody comes and wants to pay $500,000 for this company, I'm totally willing to take that. And if the other person says, I'm not, that right there is something you should talk about and deal with. Is this where we want to keep going? You know, this is a fundamental difference, because when that event comes around, it's all going to blow up in your face.
Yeah. It's much easier to have those conversations as you're starting, before you have that situation, than what is it like? A game plan is all good until you get punched in the face, right? Like Mike Tyson or whatever. like think about and plan all that shit before it happens, so that when it happens, you know what the answer is and what the scenario is and how you're going to react and stuff, at least, so that there's less surprises. So I don't know. I think a lot of these had similar veins and a lot of different angles on the similar perspectives that people had, which is really cool, I think, for us to see.
Except for the don't fuck with the cartels.
The Mexican cartels was definitely unique in the biker gang.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that that's a new lesson we can use as a takeaway today. Don't fuck with the cartels.
Yeah, that's for sure. A really good thread from Hacker News. I'm sure it will keep building over the next, few days. So this will go out just in a few days. So we'll definitely link to the thread in the show notes for this episode. And if anybody has anything they'd like to add or kind of comment on of what we talked about, love to hear from you. podcast@roguestartups.com, or leave a comment in the show notes for this episode.
And of course, if you are listening to this and you're enjoying it, be sure to share it with somebody who you think might appreciate it as well. And that would make us super happy. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.